The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Roger geeks out on ag tech. Jennifer gets into systems engineering, and man, can she engineer a system. Another pitcher throws a curve. Can we catch it? More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
John, welcome to The Cyber Show. Tell us your name, name of your company, and what you do.
Great. Hi, Fred. Nice to be here. John DiBenedetti. I'm the CEO of a startup making assistive mobility devices, smart wheelchairs. And our product is called Abby, and we're hoping to launch it next year.
Okay. What's the difference between a smart wheelchair and a dumb wheelchair?
Smart wheelchair has machine vision, cameras, and sensors for safety.
Wait, hang on. Okay. So now
it's about the tech, Fred.
Oh my goodness. This is a completely different world, right? We've had mechanical wheelchairs for a long time. Then we had electric ones where you have the mechanical control, but you're talking about what, like automatic driving cars, but in a wheelchair, right?
But if you look behind me, if you see me on the camera here, you'll see
it's the radio. You can't see anything.
So actually Abby is a traditional wheelchair form factor. So with the big back wheels and the castering front wheels. So what we're doing is we're injecting into that format, right? The standard mechanical wheelchair format, motors, and a brain.
A brain. So look, this is The Cyber Show. So we're all about the cyber.
Cool.
So let's start out with, automatic self-driving cars have a tendency to decide based on their learning that they're going to run into police cars.
We're not trying to turn a wheelchair into an automatic self-driving car.
This is Car Week around here. So okay. I was sort of hoping, you'd have the super wheelchair, you go like 95 miles an hour, but it's not.
It's not like that. But let me give you a scenario, Fred. So it's as we age, as we get older, people who self-propel themselves in a standard wheelchair, it gets more difficult to use a standard wheelchair independently.
Oh, I mean, it hurts, right? And you get older, you're weaker. Yeah,
exactly. And you have repetitive strain, shoulder injuries.
Yeah, you can't see as well, right?
Exactly. Now, what happens? So we motorize a standard traditional wheelchair. We do it very affordably. We go one step further, and that's what I was talking about, smart. What makes a wheelchair smart is Abby has some sensors on it and some cameras so that it can avoid collisions. There's nothing worse than the horror story of you buy your elderly relative, a family saves up, gets a power chair for grandma in the nursing home. She starts banging into things and they take away her wheelchair privileges.
Or rolling down the steps.
Exactly. We want to avoid that. And that's what a smart wheelchair, it differentiates from a regular
car. That's collision avoidance, right?
Exactly.
All right. So it doesn't have automatic steering, but it has collision avoidance. So it's not going that fast. So it'll stop if it gets too close to something.
Correct.
Just like you automatic braking on your car, right?
Correct. And you can configure the thresholds. How close do you want to let it get to some things? Now, there is the ability to remote control it. So let's say you're out in the park.
Oh, hang on. Now we're talking. Okay. So grandma, I don't like where you're going. I'm going to take over the remote control and drive you down the steps, right?
For example. But we wouldn't let that happen.
All right. So the automation will keep you from driving. Even the remote control can't take you down the stairs, right?
It'll in fact, yeah. The person in the chair has a panic button you won't be able to drive grandma off into the railroad tracks. Grandma maintains control.
My grandmother is long gone, so that's not. But me, I'm more worried about me. You know, driving me off the tracks. Okay. So now the automation, how does it do this? It has what are the set of sensors it uses?
So we've got four corner, very very inexpensive LiDAR sensor, time of flight sensors. And
so hang on, everybody in the audience doesn't know what LiDAR is or means. So tell us what the initials LIDAR mean.
Yeah, it's one of the, there are ultrasonic sensors, there are laser light sensors. This is a light based sensor, and it's a very small, you'll see a little lens on a corner of the product, and in there is beaming out something, reading the beam back when it bounces off things, and then the brain compares the distance it measures to the threshold you've set and takes an action, whether that's alert, make a sound, or stop driving.
But if I accidentally put my coat over the top of it, it's going to say you're bumping into stuff all the time.
Correct, correct. And you could disable that corner if you wanted to leave your sweater over it. You could actually turn off that corner sensor in case you wanted to.
All right, so it has LiDAR. What else does it have?
And it has cameras. And the cameras are used for simple things like so you can see behind you when you're backing up. Many people have neck and spine injuries, makes it difficult. And in a wheelchair, in a motorized wheelchair, you're constantly going forward and backwards, right? It's quite.
Oh, hang on. So do you have a video display then?
Yeah, it has a touch. It has a small video on the joystick controller. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you're about to go backwards, just like in a car when you back up the TV now shows what's. Oh, okay. So now. Oh, it's almost like you're driving an up-to-date car.
Correct. And this is long overdue and not difficult technologically. And in fact, the industry has not really got there. And we want to inject that kind of technology into the basic wheelchair format.
Does it have anti-lock braking?
You don't really. It has safety brakes. It has electromechanical brakes that lock the wheels when the power is off, so that you'll never roll down a hill. So as soon as the joystick is neutralized, right, as soon as you stop applying a go command, then the wheels lock. And if I was to yank out the battery, they'd stay locked. And you have to physically unlock them in order to push the wheelchair.
All right. So even in San Francisco, where you have these steep hills, you could potentially go up and down the hills, although I don't know if I'd want to in a wheelchair because I'd just be worried.
Yeah, but the wheels, when you're not applying a go command, when you're not actually driving, the wheels are locked.
Yeah, it's fail-safe.
Exactly.
Okay, cool, because I love to use the term fail-safe, and it applies here. And so, cool. All right, so it has fail-safe mechanisms. Great. So how long does the battery run?
So the battery is 10 amp hours by default. We also offer a smaller density airline one. So it'll last several days.
It's radio. They can't see what you just held up.
I didn't expect them to. I was speaking. I was just showing you. I didn't say anything that required a visual, Fred. I'm way ahead of you. I'm with you. So it's a 10 amp hour battery pack that disappears into the armrests.
How long?
So it'll last. It depends on usage, of course, and whether you're going up hills and whether you're having.
I'm going up days. Days. You can run days going uphill all the time.
No. Going a heavy guy like you or me going uphill all the time, you're going to get roughly 5-6 hours of runtime if you're outdoors going up and down hills.
Right, when it goes downhill, does it have regenerative braking?
No, we don't have regen.
The battery's rechargeable. So do you plug in the chair or do you pull out the battery and plug that in separately?
You take out the battery and recharge it, and you can carry a spare.
That's just what I was going to ask next. Okay, so I can have a spare battery. Pluck that sucker in and go.
Right, basically, virtually unlimited range. Right, you carry a spare that you can recharge anywhere on the road, so you have virtually unlimited range if you have that extra battery pack.
Nice. Okay. All right. Just so we know, it's less than $1 million each, right?
It's going to be less than $4,000 each, and over time, we're going to offer a basic version with a little less of the tech, but still a bunch of it for less than $2,000.
Is it internet connected?
It has, yes, it is internet connected as well.
So that gives, that means that the little screen there, I can use that to cruise the web while I'm driving.
No, no, we don't give you that. But the purpose of the connectivity is like threefold. So have you ever heard of SAR, socially assistive robotics, right? We have the ability to extend using that connectivity. We have proof of concept apps to extend the reach of your family and your caregivers. So, for example, you can
you get lost because you have a problem with your head as well, or you get hit or injured, and they can roll the chair to somewhere safe. They can tell where you are, that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, there's location based. Number one, yes, it can report its location in a panic mode. You can do that with your cell phone too. We try not to make anything that's redundant with your other devices. But for example, while you're sitting in Abbey, your family member can push a message directly to the touchscreen with a yes no answer, like, "Hey, did you take your morning meds? Did you drink enough water?" And you can set up time of day. There's a lot of technology now, and like SaaS platforms and SaaS applications,
software as a
subscription apps that are designed to combat loneliness and accompany, like companionship robotics is a field of is a growing field.
So Abby is going to be your friend and connect
exactly.
with you.
Okay. Exactly.
Will it allow the salespeople that are taking advantage of older people to connect to you in your Abbey and steal from you as you're riding, or is that no?
Not at all. No. This is not about. It's of course, your family member, or you would configure it, and so it's not like a public. It's not like you have it's not like another phone number for scammers to call you on. It's a closed network where you can say, "I want my son or my daughter to be able to monitor my location." And since they're able to communicate with that particular Abbey, they can then like set up Q&A prompts, that time of day reminders, and things like that to basically give them extended reach and visibility.
Pretty cool. All right. So if they want to invest or they're interested in, can they buy one today?
I have 30 units manufactured.
All right. They can buy one today, right?
No. Because no. I'm raising seed funding to commercialize.
We can't talk about raising money on the air.
Fair enough.
They can go to thecybershow.co, click on the GWiz if they're an accredited investor, and they can get in touch with you. And you say you're looking for pilots?
Yeah, we're doing pilots now. So we've manufactured 30 units. Founders have been bootstrapping for a couple of years, and we've manufactured our first 30 units. We're currently doing pilots.
Hang on. You need an FDA license for this?
So Abbey is a personal electric vehicle, not a medical device. However, after our first year selling direct to consumer as a personal electric vehicle, Abbey is designed and will clear 510K as a class 2 medical device. So there'll be a second as a two-sided model, primarily direct to consumer over the counter as a personal electric vehicle. And then by 2025, you'll be able to use your insurance benefits to get Abbey prescribed as a class 2 medical device.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Full of double. Papers flying. Everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their GWiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. P01135809, you win the lottery. Wait a minute. Oh, that's the new website with the most traffic of any site so far this year, and it only opened up a couple days ago. Actually, I'm not sure what it is, but it's breaking news on the Cyber Show. Angel to Exit's next free monthly advisory session is on Tuesday, September 9th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. If you'd like to attend, go to thecybershow.co and click on A2E Monthly Free Advisory Session. Email me from there and request an invitation. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2.
We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening.
On September 12th, join the Enterprise Leadership Network at the Monterey Plaza Hotel for their Cybersecurity and Digital Forensics Retreat. Connect with a powerful network of C-level peers from the world's most innovative organizations. The Enterprise Leadership Forum is a relaxed, invitation-only forum where you can travel somewhere beautiful, have intimate conversations with other enterprise leaders, and walk away from the experience with real takeaways and genuine connections. If you'd like to get an invitation, click on the link at thecybershow.co and get in touch with Chris to apply for membership.
Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. I'm going to start the discussion today with LinkedIn scams. LinkedIn scams use the social media platform LinkedIn, it's no surprise there, to try and connect to people in order to engage with them ultimately for one of a variety of reasons. There's the cryptocurrency scammers that are trying to take money from you. There's the female impersonators or female foreign intelligence operatives that are trying to gain access to your confidential information from your company, something like that, what have you. There's any number of motives that they have. There are a couple of signs. The first sign is, well, they connect to you. Usually it's a young, attractive profile claiming wealth or something like that. They apparently have no interest in doing business with you. You know, they're not in that forum for business, even though it's a business forum. They start a random chat that has nothing to do with working together. They might use the daily message, it's a beautiful day and you should be happy type message, this sort of thing. But ultimately, they usually want to get you to go to some other application to carry on a conversation outside of LinkedIn. So you'll see either WhatsApp or, you know, some other similar sort of social media or so-called private interaction forum where they can, well, exploit you in various ways. So let's just drill down a little bit. I want to take on the particularly interesting one that's being widely publicized today is the foreign intelligence scams, where intelligence operators from Russia, North Korea, China, Iran, generally the folks we consider to be bad actors, what they're trying to do is gain access to sensitive information or information that they can use to build up their economic capabilities or defeat, we'll call it the West, and their technological capacities to, defend themselves, do war. And then the other thing is they're, always trying to do influence operations. So anything that can assist in their influence operations, gain access to information that might be compromising and so forth. So those are the things that they're looking for in those intelligence scams. I'm going to start with an article from
Wired Security, March 15th, 2023, 7 a.m. A spy wants to connect with you on LinkedIn. Russia, North Korea, Iran, and China have been caught using fake profiles to gather information. But the platform's tools to weed them out only go so far.
In this case, there was targeting of a news person, reporter, analyst, what have you, that was being threatened by Iranian government officials and targeted. So as part of that targeting, when they couldn't do it by their means, they used LinkedIn as a path in.
When the fake account emailed reporter, her suspicions were raised by a PDF that said the U.S. State Department had provided $500,000 to fund a research project.
When I saw the budget, it was so unrealistic.
At this point, the attackers tried to ask the reporter to join a Zoom call. They wanted to send some links to review, wanted to send emails, all sorts of other things. And of course, the reporter, very suspicious at that point in time, said it's clear that they want to hack my computer. Because this is the typical behavior of people trying to get into systems, is that they'll try and get different paths for you to click on a link, run a program of theirs, load something, run an application that's insecure, and so forth.
The fake LinkedIn profile, which was created in the previous year, listed the real person's correct work and education histories and used the same image from the real Twitter and LinkedIn accounts. Much of the biography text on the fake page had been copied from profiles of the real profile as well.
The group ultimately wants to gain access to people's Gmail or Twitter accounts to gather private information. They can collect intelligence, and then they use it for other targets.
In another example, a fake account was connected to a hacking group that pretended to be a recruiter from Meta. They started asking how their weekend was before inviting them to complete a programming challenge and start the hiring process and so forth. The programming challenge turned out to be a scam designed to deploy malware to the target's computer. The idea was, of course, they had to load something onto their computer in order to take the test in the officially authorized way. The LinkedIn information didn't contain any grammatical errors or typos or anything like that, so it looked pretty convincing. In fact, there's no reason to believe that it was any different than what an actual Meta employment process might be like. The clever ones, you know, they actually go through the real process and then, you know, create a fake. They might record the process so that when they make their phony versions, they're extremely realistic. So that's one example from China and one from Iran. I guess it's time to get examples from, well, let's go for North Korea and Russia next. The UK's National Cybersecurity Center provides a lot of information that's useful about attacks and threats against the UK. And in particular, it focuses obviously on cybersecurity, trying to make the UK a better, safer place to work in the cyber environment. This is an example of an article that they published recently about Russian and Iranian threats using cyber.
UK cyber experts warn of targeted phishing attacks from actors based in Russia and Iran. Advisory highlights techniques used by attackers and spear phishing campaigns. In an advisory published today, the National Cybersecurity Center, NCSC, a part of GCHQ, shared details about the techniques and tactics used by the attackers as well as mitigation advice to combat the continuing threat. The advisory highlights that throughout 2022 separate malicious campaigns were conducted by Russia-based group Cyborgium and Iran-based group TA-453, also known as APT-42, to target a range of organizations and individuals in the UK and elsewhere for information gathering purposes.
These are typical of spear phishing campaigns of this sort. The actor targets specific individuals or groups using information known to be of interest to the targets and engages them. A spear phishing campaign typically has somebody that the actor perceives to be their target that has direct access to the information that the attacker wants. Basically, they're looking at an access vector directly to the information, or in some cases, a vector to another target or both. So they use open source resources to get reconnaissance, including social media, professional networking platforms, and so forth. They identify, you know, the hooks that engage the target, the things that get them talking. And then they take the time to research the interests and identify real-world social professional contacts. This is the classic elicitation tactic that we've seen, you know, certainly since the Cold War and before. They've also created fake social media or networking profiles that impersonate well-known, respected experts. They use those supposed conference or other event invitations and other false approaches from journalists to try to engage in conversation. They typically have webmail addresses from different providers. Their initial approach impersonates some known contact of the target whenever possible, or some eminent name in the target's field of interest or their sector. They've also created malicious domains resembling legitimate organizations that appear to be authentic. So, for example, it might look like Microsoft, or it might look like a news organization or a conference, or you name it. They show a distinct preference for personal email addresses. So they want to send emails to the target's personal email, not to their work email. This, among other things, avoids the business automation that tries to detect such things. You know, it's more about, oh, boy, you're really great, as opposed to I just found you through your company. This also, of course, circumvents other security protocols that companies have in place. The next step is to build rapport. They take the time to get information on your interests, and they find mutual interests. This is, you know, common psychological operation sort of stuff. They'll establish some contact on a topic that's sort of unrelated to what they're looking for to create that relationship and get rapport with the target. And then ultimately, they're going to deliver some malicious link, right? They're going to use some other sort of trade craft. These aren't typically going to be people that just elicit by conversation, communications, physical introduction, and so forth. They're going to take the more direct approach to gaining access, give you access to a website or a document that you're looking for, something like that. Always something that they control. And they're always going to want the user to enter some account credentials. Obviously, you know, they want to take you to a familiar site so you can go log into it and give them a user ID and password. So, you know, this is why if you use the same password to many accounts, once they get into one, they'll get into many. And then they'll also put malicious links in so they can, you know, drop software on your system to, you know, capture keystrokes or watch the video, you name it. Then they've also included malicious links displayed like Zoom meeting URLs. Right? In one case, they even set up a Zoom call to share the malicious URL in the chat of the Zoom session. So you click on the URL, and then it takes you into their malicious site. There's also a multi-persona impersonation using two or more actors to create a group of people talking to you. For example, for a conference, they'll have the organizer and somebody else each communicating with you in different modes to make it much more legitimate appearing. At some point, you know, they start to exploit things. They'll gain access to something. They'll gain control over a computer. They'll get a login to a site, something like that, and land and expand, right? Once they have credentials, they'll log into your email accounts. They may alter emails en route, do other things to create Trojan horses, steal emails, steal attachments, forge attachments other places to get responses and then listen for the responses so you don't even know you sent the email and you don't know that the response came back, do forwarding and so forth. So they've also used their access to gain access to mailing lists so they can get other contacts and expand their ability to do this across the space. So this is sort of the typical Russian-Iranian group approach. One of the newest frauds on the internet today is a multi-step process. It starts with an initial contact offering something you want or need for your job. Then as you start to communicate, you get a link or a file emailed to you, chatted to you, texted to you, or connected to you through a social media application. When you open this file or click on the link, it displays a message indicating that it was corrupted and could not be opened. But in reality, it contains malicious code that merely displays that message and leaves a Trojan horse on your computer. Once that Trojan horse is in place, the attacker is in your system and expands their access to perform any of a number of malicious acts, typically ranging from extortion, this is often in the form of ransomware, to financial theft, for example, by altering banking information on an invoice. What can you do about it? Well, there's nothing much you can really do to prevent this sort of deception from working. The reason is that if you don't use the internet to get in touch with people in order to get your job done, you're likely not to be able to get the job done. But when you encounter the situation, you can recognize this scenario. And if you do, you can immediately contact whoever's in charge of cybersecurity and have them fix the problem before it gets worse. In the meanwhile, try and be safe out there, but don't imagine you're going to be perfect against modern threats. This segment is called, How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it.
This week we told you that people create fake domains that look just like real ones. How do they do that? It turns out that there are many characters that are allowed in domain names that look very similar. For example, a lowercase o looks the same as scores of other characters from math, symbols, other languages and so forth. All you have to do is register one of those domain names for a few dollars a year and you can start to make a fake.
And that's how you do that. Tuesday, September 19th, go to Angel. Fill out GWiz, present your company, get on the show, and make a fortune. Or not. To sign up, go to thecybershow.co and click on Go to Angel and accelerate your company. Roger Royce is one of the most well-known and well-positioned attorneys working on cyber issues, particularly in the ag tech arena, but also in many other areas. He also has a tremendous understanding of influence and related issues, as we'll see in our discussions.
Okay, Roger, let's talk ag tech, because it is the cyber show, and virtually all, I think all of ag tech is cybernetic systems, right? There's sensors, actuators, communications, and control. So talk to us about the ag tech world. What is it? How did it come to be? How did it get to where it is now? And of course, you played a big role in it, so you must know what's the inside scoop.
Yeah. So I'm from an agricultural area. My earliest clients were farmers and growers out in the Midwest. And through kind of a tortuous path, I ended up in Silicon Valley. But 10, 12 years ago, we saw the Climate Corp deal, and that got everyone's attention. That was an almost $1 billion exit company that was an ag tech company. I mean, I had ag tech clients before then doing irrigation systems, et cetera. But that got a lot of attention, got my attention too. And it was about that time that I met the mayor of Salinas, who's also a farmer, a Radicchio farmer named Dennis Donahue.
Yeah, I know Dennis. We work with him, and there's an ag tech incubator in Salinas that we should also mention that's run by the Growers Association.
Yeah, the Western Growers. Yeah, I know it well. So I met Dennis. We had dinner out at a restaurant here in Silicon Valley on Sand Hill Road, and it's the first time I'd heard somebody talk about ag tech as a sector and talk quite so passionately about it. And he persuaded me that this was a really big thing, and it was going to be a big thing, and there was a lot of room for innovation in agriculture. And that's when I decided to take a look around and see how I could help the system.
Let's just take a second here and talk about the reason for that innovation. There are a couple of underlying reasons that I'm aware of, and you probably know it more. One of them is it's hard to get workers. So the ag tech workers were aging out. At this point, you know, trying to get somebody to go work in the fields is very difficult, and you can't keep importing them from, you know, poor places forever. And so it's hard to get the workers. And then the cost keeps going up. And there's difficulty associated with provenance. And there's an enormous challenge associated with weather and other outside conditions. And so the ability to, we're not going to say control, but control for those conditions produces tremendous potential cost savings. And then there's, you know, the agronomist issues and the ability to see what's going on in the field. So the surveillance of what's going on in the fields to rapidly detect the spread of a disease or detect when there's too much or not enough water and so forth become efficiency tools for the person, for the grower. And that has a tremendous value in terms of making crops, you know, less expensive, higher volume with less failure rates, and making farmers financially stable. All right. So I've laid out a bunch of stuff, and I probably missed a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of factors at play. It's like a perfect storm, and you should add water into that as well. But food security is probably number one. That's the thing that most people talk about first. The fact that, you know, we've got a rapidly expanding population, but we don't have any more land being produced. So we've got to figure out a way for precision ag to get more product out of the same amount of acreage, more output out of fewer inputs. Let me put it that way. But like I said, I think consumerism is playing a big part in this. People want to know where their food comes from. They want to know, you know, how it was made, and, you know, organic is getting bigger all the time. How do you trace that? For example, labor is huge, right? Probably the problems we have with labor, farm labor now, because the farm labor population is aging. The average age is, you know, almost my age, you know? And the newer generations are not going into that industry like they used to. So that means the cost is going up. And by the way, I've been to Salinas. I've been to the fields. I've met these people. I've walked the fields. I've been out there, you know, chopping celery with them just to see how it's done. So I understand it is backbreaking, difficult work.
It's tough, and you have to be precise, and you have to be quick. It's a very skilled labor force in a lot of ways, and not recognized as that.
That's for sure. I tried to pick strawberries one day. I'm terrible at it. I would starve to death if I had to make.
And that's one that automation has still not gotten really right. The only automated strawberry picking mechanisms that are sort of effective is where they cut it off on the stem. They don't actually pick the strawberry; they just cut the stem off. But that's a technology they're getting closer and closer to. So robotics is a tremendously important component of that. Sorry to interrupt. Keep going.
No, you're absolutely right. The robotics is a big part of this. And all of that, precision farming, robotics, artificial intelligence, machine learning, replacing the chemicals that are put into the ground with biologics. I mean, all of that, I think a lot of that is being helped by the fact that labor is getting more expensive and more scarce. And that makes it very worthwhile for companies to try to figure out how to be more efficient through machinery. And I think it makes the conditions, the working conditions, better for the people who do work as well. So, but that's driving a lot of ag tech, no doubt about it. What's going on in the developing world is certainly driving ag tech, especially China. Well, up till recently, China. I think China's more of a competitor in ag tech now, even though there's still a market. And by the way, I've been to China, traveled all over, meeting ag tech companies. They've got 300 different, my last count, 300 different institutions working on ag tech in China right now. So there's a lot of development and their issues.
Have you been to India with this? Because India is an agricultural economy and has been for a long time and has enormous problems with pollution and other stuff that went into the ground because of the population.
Yeah, India is also modernizing. I'm seeing a lot of ag tech companies out of India, especially around water, etc. No, we had planned on going to India, but then COVID came along and I haven't gotten that back on track yet, but I will, because it's a huge market. And by the way, there's a huge opportunity in India and in Southeast Asia generally, because they have to ramp up pretty quickly. They still have food security problems in that part of the world. So it's a much different issue for them. It's not just.
So hang on. Let's not leave out South America and Africa. So what do you think of those areas as well?
I'm doing tons of stuff with African companies right now. I've seen more African companies now than any time in my career. Again, that entire part of the world, you know, technology is really can make a huge difference there. And it's kind of like, because the world up until 20, 30 years ago, the World Bank just gave countries like that money for food. Then they stopped. So now they got to figure out how to produce this food themselves. And it's almost like you hear about these countries that skipped the landline, went right to cell phones. That's kind of what some of these other countries are like. They're going right to the latest, greatest technology without having gone through Ag 1.0 and Ag 2.0.
Yeah, so global innovation in ag tech is fantastic. And the opportunity is beyond belief. From a financial standpoint, from a startup standpoint, but there's also just the sheer technology advancement that's continuing. So let's take a pause here. So what do you think, Chris?
So in 1968, 69, I was 3 or 4 years old, and I'm sitting watching a little black and white TV, and there's this guy on TV, and he looked very authoritative, and he's explaining very calmly that the Earth can only ever feed 3.54 billion people, and it's currently 2.52 billion people, which is why 100 million Americans would starve to death in 1970. And I didn't know what all of those numbers and words meant, but I remembered it, found out what the words meant, and that was a population bomb, 1968 bestseller, on every boomer bookshelf, and talking about carrying capacity and so forth. The Earth can't produce more than. And, you know, in today we make 30% more food per person with 8 billion people than we did then, because we don't continue to do things the same way. And of all the inevitability curves I've followed all of my life from the very beginning, this one is bloody obvious. And the conversation you two just had lays the groundwork for so much of it. We are still, to be clear, that we make much more food per person. Global starvation as a percentage of population has gone from 35% when I was born to 10 or 12. 8, depending on who you look at. And we are still just basically throwing seeds in the mud and hoping for rain. There is so much room for improvement in our ability to produce food. And yes, ag tech is key to it. We're basically still in the Stone Age. So it's fascinating. Yeah, well,
and we talked about this with PowerGrow at length, right? I mean, it's not just that we're doing so much better today and that ag tech is such a huge deal. I mean, think about it. Everybody's got to eat. So you got 8 billion customers guaranteed in the total.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No one's opting out. Yeah.
Yep. 8 billion and growing.
And growing. Yeah.
But in terms of understanding the science behind it, we're nowhere near understanding the science of how all that stuff works, even though we're making enormous progress. And if we're ever going to get off the Earth before the sun explodes and we fall into it, you know, it's going to be necessary that we understand enough about that to be able to create, you know, successful ability to grow what we need as we go from planet to planet. So we have an unbelievable distance to go, right? And then just, you know, in my house, we now grow more and more of the food that we use. And in particular, what I think is maybe much more important than growing the food is growing these spices and the other related things. So my wife goes out into the front of the house and picks the things that she's going to grind up into the things that she makes when she cooks stuff. And it's fabulous. You know, talk about being fresh and healthy, right? So organic farming is taking off. It's harder to do it organically than not organically. But on the other hand, we're perfecting it as a society.
As we see with supply chain security today, right? You know, I've spent most of my professional time in this space right now, and the details are fascinating. And I think it's very clear we're going to solve that issue. But by doing so, we do the same sort of things you just mentioned and guest mentioned, that people want to know these things. You need a system to show that this food was made the way you as a consumer want it. Oh, and once you put that system in, you provide visibility into the entire process, which leads you endless opportunities to say, that's inefficient, that's inefficient, that's ineffective. So the whole process is recursive. And of the, say, the, you know, if, you know, from, you know, the World War One era, where one in two Americans worked in the field producing food, I think we've made 1% of the progress that we'll make over the next, you know, several hundred years or a thousand years, whatnot, in agriculture. But that 1% is amazing.
I don't think we're anywhere near 1% here, Chris.
Well, yeah, whatever the numbers are. But yes, we've made amazing improvements, but we're still using incredibly primitive methods. You know, we will double and double and double our ability to produce food. And no, it's not going to be Grey Goo. You know, it will actually turn out to be cheaper and better.
Which brings me to Soylent Green, which I just saw the movie Soylent Green again. Wonderful movie for its time, but its vision of the future where people were essentially farm animals to create, you know, food for the elites or something. You know, it's just completely wrong. The apocalypse is not here. And now the apocalypse that may be coming has to do with, you know, climate change. And we're starting to see those effects in a very big way. And that has an enormous effect on farming and growing. And so when the hot gets too hot, then the water, you know, availability of water is up because there's more water in the air. But the heat plus the excessive water destroys crops. So indoor growing is becoming much, much more important, right?
Well, and, you know, when I talk about inevitability curves, and I sort of see these or feel these things in my head, it's a very tactile sort of thing. And, you know, inevitably we will produce more food, and I've no doubt about all that. But I worry about, you know, the best I can describe it, the way it feels to me is metal fatigue, right? You can snap that inevitability curve. You can break it entirely, and you won't get the rest of it. And you're right. You know, climate change concerns me a great deal. We have to match our ability to innovate and engineer with every challenge, and this challenge over the next several decades is going to be a heck of a one.
You talk
that's
about
three bad years, and that has global long-term effects. Right?
You talk about metal fatigue, and I'm talking about mental fatigue.
Yeah.
All right, moving right along. Angel to Exit's next free monthly advisory session is on Tuesday, September 9th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. If you'd like to attend, go to thecybershow.co and click on A2E Monthly Free Advisory Session. Email me from there and request an invitation.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking here with Jennifer Bayuk. Jennifer was one of the first chief information security officers on Wall Street and has a long and storied career before and after that. Okay, so you said, all right. I have money. I have time. I've always wanted to do this. So you got to, what did you get a PhD in?
Systems engineering.
Okay. So now we talk about systems engineering nobody knows what it is. So, and you've told me what it is and I've seen what it is and I think I know what it is, but I certainly know that I can't describe it correctly and that you can.
Well, I will try. Systems engineering deals with anything that you can call a system, which means you can break it down into components that can be individually defined and analyzed. And when you design a system, you design it in kind of what they call a V model. You start with a concept, the purpose, the vision of what the system's supposed to do. And you break it down into functions like a black box. Okay, what are the inputs of that? What are the outputs of that? And you keep getting components smaller and smaller till you can build something that then you can fit together.
Apollo, so it's a hierarchical top-down.
The Apollo project was the first systems engineering project. It's a V, because once you get to the bottom and you build the components, you have to integrate them to get them back together to produce the system that you envisioned. So all of the components start getting put together, and you test and you create metrics and you make sure that your vision is being preserved as you're actually building the system up from those small components that you designed.
Okay, so now let's talk reality. In the internet today, nothing is systems engineered at all. Is that correct?
That is not correct, because all manufacturing uses systems engineering. I mean, this is a very common thing that engineers use for bridges and big projects.
All right, but you're saying the hardware, okay? But the internet hardware is not what I'm talking about, right? I'm talking about everything else.
Well, the internet is kind of organically grown up. It's not designed. So, yes, it's not.
It's bottom up.
Right.
And it's just sort of, you know, what is it? My son has a term for this. We created the P&ST division of Thoughtful Toys, which is procrastinate and slap together.
Yes. Now, in systems engineering, we understand that systems can be complicated, right? But when you break them down and you know how the components work, they are understandable. You know how they fit back together. When you get all to right. the point where the components have behavioristic patterns that are not predictable, then we call it a complex system. And you can't analyze it to figure out how it's going to work by looking at its components. You have to look at its behavior.
Okay, so let's start out with this whole notion, which first of all, of course, everything you just said, I said, of course. So, of course.
Of course. Makes sense.
So essentially, every non-trivial system, non-trivial, anything at the internet scale or anything like that, is a composition of components. And there are lots of problems with this systems engineering approach in that you can't really fully specify what it is the properties of those components are. And even if you could, that doesn't allow you any method to clearly define the properties of the composite. And so that's hierarchical going up. And this was one of the big problems with security, is that security deals with these composites. It's never just the component, it's the system as a whole. And today we don't even try to describe what the so-called security is supposed to be. Right. That is, at best, we can say, well, there are a couple of things we'd like to see, like availability, right, and integrity and use control and transparency. But those are big, huge words, and there's no way to even translate those into the mechanisms of what the hardware and software does. Is that a good characterization of the problem?
Well, there are multiple problems in what you have described. One of which I think you're referring to is that as you try to secure a system or take a system and give it properties that it doesn't have, you're actually changing the system out from under itself as you are trying to give it a new feature. And it's hard to preserve something the way it used to work, which is why when people implement security, they often break things because they're bolting things onto things that don't have places where you can put a screw in without causing a leak. So there's a lot of interaction, and there's a great analogy. I don't know if I'll do it justice, but in the Seven Samurai of systems engineering, and it talks about how you've got the system as it exists today, and then the system that you want it to be, and then your transition plan. And as you're putting your transition plan together, it's
both the state and the target are moving as you try to do that. But another important thing is almost never can you go from one so-called secure state to another with security in between. So you're always breaking it along the way. But we don't even know the list of properties that we would want to achieve in a system. We don't have a set of language that allows us to describe all of those things. There's no hope of achieving it if we can't even say what it is. Is that right?
We have words that we can use to describe the outcome and the end state. And those are called system security principles, least privilege, segregation of duties. These things are...
All right. So hang on. So you have a list of things, right? That's called a nominal metric.
It'll be a different list for each system. I'm just saying it's at the principle level that you can do validation. You can
Wait a minute. That list is not complete.
It's hard for it not to be complete when it says the system will do what its mission describes and nothing else.
No, but the description of the mission is incomplete, right? That is, these descriptions, these human descriptions, are these conceptual things that are interpreted by different people differently. But in terms of actually being able to accomplish it, there's no way you can measure technically to determine whether you've achieved it.
That's why we call it validation. Technically, if you're just measuring attributes of something and you're seeing whether they exist according to your plan, you're verifying that you've built the system correctly as per your specs. So you can verify, okay, but you can't validate. That's what you're saying. You validate by saying it works as you expected, and because you have not articulated your expectations to the extent that you can get a metric for it, that's where you can't validate.
All right, well, that's one problem, but let's go back to the verification problem.
Okay. Right?
Because one of the things you said was, and nothing else.
Right.
And of course, there is no such thing. You cannot have a system that's, you know, both consistent and complete. That's mathematically proven, of course,
right.
which brings us to the problem that you can't tell me what all those properties are. It's not just that you don't know how, it's that it's not possible to do so.
Right. That's why we still have rocket ships blowing up on their first launch. We think we've listed what they should do and nothing else, but then blowing up with something in that nothing else category that we missed.
Well, okay. that's a high level consequence. Right. Mm-hmm. But even at the minutia level, nothing else. Right. So anytime you're doing a computation, in order for it to be doing nothing else, it has to be the minimum method for doing that computation. It has to use the minimum resources in every way. And of course, there are trade-offs. So anytime you have trade-offs, you're using one resource more or less than the other. And the differential between those says it's not a minimal. Right. It might be a local minimum. And of course, that's what's exploited in cybersecurity. You know, even in the best system you can ever create, there are covert channels associated with these differences, right? So this stuff is just impossibly hard to do to a level of perfection.
Now, I love systems engineering. You know, when I was a kid, I believe my dad's title at IBM was system engineer, but it was the green plastic flowchart template thing and the pencil and the graph paper, right? And I love systems engineering conversations because at the end of the day, you know, I see things the way Jennifer does, right? You know, that somehow we're trying to do these things. This leads to that, at least, you know, you can put things together at that level. You know, I see where you're going with, you know, the conversation there. And yeah, things are sort of irreducibly complex, you know, for security and perhaps in other, you know, other ways. However, a systems engineering approach is just such a healthy way to think about things.
So when I was at Sandia, that's really where I learned systems engineering more than anything else. And there's a really good book on on security engineering written by a woman who did this at Sandia for many years, associated with the nuclear weapons complex, but it's for securing facilities and so forth and understanding perimeters and such. That book is Design and Evaluation of Physical Protection Systems by Mary Lynn Garcia. And, you know, the imperfection is something that is the nature of the world. And one of the big differences people don't seem to understand about the world as it exists today in this anything from anywhere type of world is that they give you the analogy to making a bridge that doesn't fall over, right? So engineering historically has made bridges that don't fall over, right? They're designed for this amount of wind and that amount of shake and so forth. And originally they shook themselves apart, right? Because of certain frequencies of wind, they had positive feedback and blew up. They've gotten rid of that in essentially all cases now. They figured that out. But that has to do with the environment it operates in. If you say we're going to build bridges so that no matter what, no matter who does, with no matter what technology they try, those bridges aren't going to fall down, it's not going to work. Because I can, you know, you may rest assured that that nuclear weapon will take out the bridge. And probably you don't need a nuclear weapon to take out the bridge, But even if you said we're going to exclude anything blowing up, just a couple of drops of the right substance will cause things to start melting, right? The metal will fall apart. You know, there's all sorts of stuff that goes wrong in the world, and you cannot ever cover it all. And the problem that we face in today's information environment in the cyber world is that the attackers are not constrained except by what they can think of. The communication is not constrained except as you try to constrain it. And because of the interdependency chain, you know, something somewhere is always available to attack, including the fact that you can get a job working, you know, for the people that design it and make it so there's a design flaw, which is what Star Wars was about, right?
Right. You know, so in security, as we discuss all the time, is I guess the systems engineering perspective might be useful to think about it, you know, because I see blocks, you know, the curves or blocks or flowcharts or whatnot. But there's this, and they relate to each other that way. And when people say, as you sort of say with your bridge analogy, you know, make me secure. I want to be secure. It's like, that's not a thing. You know, it's like, I want a bridge that lasts forever. It's like, okay, no. You know, anything, any 100% of anything, forget it. Right? A systems engineering approach, you know, to security is like, okay, you have these blocks, like the pathfinders you and I do. It's like, you know, you sort of, there are entities inside your organization and functions and motivations and things that interact with each other. And where they interact, there's, you know, friction or, you know, call it what you will, whatever analogy you want. And at those points there's security risk. Every single one of them. And there's always going to be. So, you know,
that's
you think about an engine, right? You know, it's like bearings and everything else. You know, you have a certain metal you use for the bearings and the crankshaft for the internal combustion engine. And they will function for a given amount of time in a given environment with a given amount of lubrication. And that's it. Right? They don't last forever. There is no forever, right? You just bound things appropriate for the purposes. Now, I can charge you $10 million for the same gas motor and give you bearings that will last a long time, but not forever. That's not a thing.
No, and I think you're exactly right. And I think the key thing in my view of what you said there is, and I completely agree with you, people want something secure. And there is no such thing. It should not be a word,
right?
In language. It's cannot ever exist. It's as a concept. It's a misunderstanding. And until the people in charge, the people in governance positions, recognize and understand that, and stop trying to say that and think about it that way, and until the technical people, so it goes from the top to the bottom. In cryptography, is sort of the worst place of all, right? The cryptographic folks who are mathematicians think of the mathematics and say, I've eliminated, you know, it's the perfect system. It can never fail. They don't recognize that in engineering, I have to implement it and then it's going to fail. Because, and all the attacks that are relatively straightforward and easy to do not include the mathematics of cryptography. And they talk about quantum cryptography, you know, quantum resistant and so forth. Yeah. That's fine, but frankly, I don't need any quantum anything to break your cryptographic system. All I need is one wrong bit in your operating system somewhere, right?
Well, yeah, even less than that. You know, it's one little quip, you know, that I've used pretty well my entire career, you know, holds true to this day, right? You know, look, you know, if the, for example, the National Security Agency takes a deep personal interest in you, you know, encrypt whatever you feel like.
Yeah,
right? There's a microphone in your sock drawer, whatever, right?
You
know,
there's
literally, yeah, you lose. You know, somebody has no, you know, there you typed in the code, you that was recorded. Yes. We literally, everybody knows this, you know, Cold War stuff, right? We hollowed out mountains and put blast doors, you know, 20 feet thick, you know, stainless steel. And that mountain in Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado is rated to a certain amount. And beyond that, it turns into dust. Everything does, right? There is no...
Exactly.
How secure you want to be. And you can be helped with that. You know, so you listen to this, right? It's not amorphous. You know, people can sit down with you. Fred and I do this sort of stuff, right? You know, there are people out there who can sit down and say, okay, who are you? What are your risks? What are you dealing with? What are you tolerating already? You know, how much? Let's get the cyber below that level. So it's less of a risk than things you're already putting up with.
On September 12th, join the Enterprise Leadership Network at the Monterey Plaza Hotel for their Cybersecurity and Digital Forensics Retreat. Connect with a powerful network of C-level peers from the world's most innovative organizations. The Enterprise Leadership Forum is a relaxed, invitation-only forum where you can travel somewhere beautiful, have intimate conversations with other enterprise leaders, and walk away from the experience with real takeaways and genuine connections. If you'd like to get an invitation, click on the link at thecybershow.co and get in touch with Chris to apply for membership. Sign up at thecybershow.co. Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on The Cyber Show, Roger talks about billions in ag tech, but does he make it? Jennifer measures risk with metrics and a sharp stick. Another pitch pours it on, but will it be a strikeout? More fraud, spies, and lies, and a new segment, How Do They Do That? You can only find out on The Cyber Show. Or can you? We'll find out next week, only on The Cyber Show.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.